In 1966, the Black Panther movement was founded. Prominent among the founders were Bobby Seale, who is its president, and Huey Newton, after Eldridge Cleaver, probably its best-known champion. In recent months, of course, the Newton wing expelled Eldridge Cleaver, who is living in Algeria, so that the Seale-Newton wing is nowadays supreme. Meanwhile, the Black Panthers have turned their backs officially on violence as a means of accomplishing whatever it is they propose to accomplish, concerning which we will in due course be enlightened. Huey Newton, you will remember, was tried and convicted of killing a policeman, specifically of involuntary manslaughter. The slogan, "Free Huey Newton," was to the late 60s what the slogan, "Who promoted Peres," was to the early 50s. The higher court reversed the verdict on a technicality, and Mr. Newton was tried twice more, the trial resulting in each case in a split jury. Finally, the presiding judge gave up, and Huey Newton is free. His mother is from Louisiana, his father from Arkansas, and he is the youngest of seven children. He was schooled in Oakland, where he now lives. His first book was called To Die for the People, and imminently he will publish his autobiography, which is called Revolutionary Suicide, a concept I shall now ask Mr. Newton please to explain.
I'll explain it, but if I may impose upon you, I have a friend who's almost dying for me to ask this question, if you will. The question is, during the revolution of 1776, when the United States of America broke away from England, my friend would like to know what side would you have been on during that time?
I think probably I would have been on the side of George Washington. I'm not absolutely sure, because it remains to be established historically whether what we sought to prove at that point might not have been proved by more peaceful means. On the whole, I'm against revolutions. Though I think as revolutions go, that was a pretty humane one.
Yeah, you're not such a bad guy after all. My friend will be surprised to hear that. I hope he's listening.
His assumption was what?
Well, he was puzzled, but I think that he was inclined to believe that you've been on the side of the colonizers of England. But I'm pleased with the answer, and I agree with you. The only revolution that is worth fighting is a humane revolution. And
also one that succeeds.
Pardon me?
Also one that succeeds.
Yes, right, eventually.
I feel that if King George had captured George Washington, he would have had the right to hang him.
According to the law.
Yeah.
But revolutions always, in some ways, contradict some laws. That's why it's called revolution.
Well, revolutionary justice is its own justice, isn't it?
Yes, and of course, it always professes to go under some human right or humane consideration. And I think that we can judge revolutions on the basis of how much, in fact, or objectively, people are given a fair, are dealt with in a fairer way, and are given more freedom. I think that one of my principles is that contradiction is the ruling principle of the universe, and everything in phenomena, whether it's the physical world or the biological world or the social world, has its internal contradiction that gives motion to things, that internal strain. And much of the time that we Homo sapiens don't realize that no matter what sort of conditions we establish, no matter what government we establish at this point, there also will be that internal contradiction that will have to be resolved, and resolved in a rational, just way. And, of course, that leads us somewhat, it's very vague on how to deal with it. And many times we claim actions are revolutionary, but really they're not. So I appreciate your answer, and I would agree with that part of it.
Which part?
The part that the only revolution is worthwhile, that is a real revolution that succeeds,
would
be a humane revolution. And
otherwise
that,
it's called an insurrection or a mutiny.
Yeah, a rebellion or a riot. Yes.
Yeah. The as I understand it, the generally accepted test of the integrity of a revolution is whether it is established, the revolution having taken place, that the people truly supported it.
A revolution cannot really succeed without the people's support.
Oh, sure it can. It's easy.
Well, changes in authority can be successful. But I think that we would have to have a functional definition. We would have to stipulate what we mean by revolution.
Well, there are revolutions, roughly speaking, every 2 or 3 months in Latin America without the people getting involved.
Well, I would probably call it by, I think just the words, I would call it a coup d'etat.
That's revolution.
By way of definition, I would reject your definition. But I'll appreciate if you want to call a coup d'etat a revolution, then I could function.
Right, if you want to call a popular revolution a popular revolution, please call it a popular revolution.
Well, then I would say that a revolution would have to be popular, or else I wouldn't label it as a revolution. I would so really we're just dealing in semantics of what a revolution is. What a revolution is made up of, in fact, and I say that we won't have to belabor that. Any rebellion that establishes a new authority, if you would like to call that revolution, then I could entertain it because, it's just a word anyway. But changes in governments and changes in the relationship people and authority and institutions, I say they take many forms, and I like to distinguish.
Mm-hmm. Sure. What would you call the thing that ousted King Farouk?
I wouldn't call it a revolution.
Even though an entirely new order was brought in?
Yes, but with coup d'etats, it's common that an entirely new order will be brought in.
No, not necessarily.
Pardon me?
Not necessarily.
I say it's possible.
No, sometimes a coup d'etat takes away one colonel and puts in another colonel.
But sometimes, but other times that a coup d'etat could establish an entirely different relationship between the institutions and the people in a particular place.
In which case is revolutionary.
Pardon me?
In which case it's revolutionary.
I say that I could function with that definition if you insist that's the only one, but I have a special, to me, revolution carries a special connotation, and of course it's only my subjective kind of feelings about it, and but I have to distinguish between changes of power and for my own way of thinking, establish calling one a flower and the other a skunk. And I wouldn't argue the absolute kind of definition to the conditions that I'm talking about.
Well, I grant that you have considerable authority in your movement. I'm not sure that you have an authority to impose your own terminology.
I argue that your definition is not necessarily a lexical definition. I already granted you, if you want to stipulate that that as a definition of revolution, I'll entertain it. But
well, maybe this is the occasion to say about the historian Macaulay that he shouldn't have referred to the glorious revolution of 1688 because it didn't fit your standard. But meanwhile, he wrote 13 volumes on the subject.
I say that he could
call it a revolution.
Well, he could refer to it any way he liked.
He did.
And I say that if we want to appreciate his...
He wasn't an imperialist, was he?
I say if we want to appreciate his definition, fine. I'm not attempting to stipulate a new definition. There are authorities that I could cite that would call a revolution a very special thing. One authority would be the scholar, philosopher, Chairman Mao Zedong, that would only call a people's movement and the overthrow of the authority by the proletarians a revolution. But I wouldn't argue,
well, actually,
I wouldn't support Chairman Mao against you and saying that that is the only definition. Unfortunately, with the English language, or the especially with the American language, that's a little different from the English language, it's a pretty vague thing, and you have so many lexical definitions that directly contradict each other. I don't think that we should belabor our audience talking about who has the authority to define a particular phenomena.
Well, not unless we want to.
Do we want to? If you want to, then I want to.
As
will be done. Huh?
As you no doubt know, the use of the word people,
yes,
the use of the term popular support,
yes,
is done by Chairman Mao, as you refer to him in your book,
mm-hmm,
with some sense of proprietorship. That is to say, he's always talking about the people,
yes,
desiring this, that,
yes,
and the other. The people are, in fact, never consulted about anything. Have never been consulted about Chairman Mao, about any of his regulations, or about his foreign policy.
Well, I differ with you. I think that too much of the time, because of our cultural differences, and that we only, again, we only consider being consulted within the scope of what we feel subjectively being consulted is all about. For instance, in China as well as in Latin America, people say that, well, there's no democracy, see, and in Cuba, because there's no putting the ballot in the box, so the people are not consulted. But on the other hand, that Fidel Castro said that the people are consulted even in a more severe way, that the authorities put to the acid test. And whether I support that procedure or not is not the point. But the acid test is, for a long time, that people can be fooled with. They can't be fooled and misused all of the time. And the test would be the doom of your authority through armed revolution. And that is the way that they're consulted in the final analysis.
I don't know what you're talking about, and I think you don't either.
Well, I'll tell you. Well, you can only speak for yourself.
And no, that's why I say I think.
I said that
that's
I'm perfectly equipped,
yeah,
to. I'll be more clear then, okay?
Yeah. You were going to explain wherein Castro is democratic.
No, I'm going to explain a principle, and the principle is how people are consulted in a democratic society.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm saying that the Westerners have a particular definition of people voting, a particular definition of what democracy is about, and I can appreciate that definition. In other words, it doesn't matter whether I accept it or not for now, but here in the West, we feel that the only time that people are given democratic rights to have a say-so is when you put the ballot in the box and you vote for a particular person within a particular framework.
The answer is not necessarily.
No, I said, okay, let me finish my proposition. I'm your guest,
yeah,
and I heard that you're a charming man,
right, and
that
I'm the
you're
host.
Polite. I don't have,
It isn't merely a matter of voting, it's a matter of expressing yourself.
I don't have to be polite and charming, because it's not my program. You owe me a special privilege. What I'm saying is that sometimes that people are heard and people participate with their say-so, and it could be called democracy because it's who defines democracy. Now, in the West, much of the time, if you're not allowed to vote by putting the ballot into the box and choosing an administration or a person, if this does not take place, then in the West we're inclined to say there's no democracy. I'm saying this is not necessarily true if democracy will be defined as everyone and all of the people getting a fair share and the fairest deal of whatever wealth is there, and some control over their administrators. Now, in armed revolution, the people are casting the ballots, certainly, And this is the acid test that some say, well, it's no need for them to go to deal in bourgeois democracy because even in the West, they say democracy, but you can't vote out private property. You can only vote within the scope of the definition of the institutions and the people and the authority who control them. And some other countries... And some other... I'll let you talk in 1 minute, Alex. And some other countries, they say, no, the people would decide what happens, and they're not relegated or bound by any definition by the interests of the authority, if it happens to be a bourgeois authority, and I mean owners, and those who control most of the wealth. I would have to appreciate if they call that the flower. I would say flower also. Now, whether we choose that form of that procedure or not, that would have to be considered by our own subjective kind of desire. And I will agree that with human affairs, that most of the times that we call our subjective desires objective. I try not to do that. And this is why that I try to be very honest in debates and just in discussions. Right.
Okay.
Yes. Thank you. Yeah. You are charming and you're very polite.
And very silent. The right of the individual to define for himself extends to the extent of his capacity to communicate. George Orwell wrote a very famous book based on Big Brother's attempt so to rob words of their meanings that war became peace. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And justice became oppression, and so on. Now, democracy consists not only in being permitted to vote, but in being permitted to organize an opposition.
Yes.
So as to discover whether people are latently on your side. There is no practice of democracy as commonly understood in Cuba. The assumption that an organization is democratic because otherwise the leader would be overthrown is naive.
There's one fallacy. I think that you would consider democracy, you could only organize an opposition within the scope as defined by the authorities who are in control in the first place. And this is true in the socialist society as well as in the capitalist society.
Give me an example.
An example is this. In this society, that you're not allowed to organize an opposition against the authority through armed resistance with the intent to overthrow the government.
But we call that rebellion.
By law, but you've already agreed that if you were in 1776, you probably would have chose Washington, and this definitely would have been against the law. And so I'm saying that when we talk about organizing opposition, that no government in this world that I know about have the audacity at this point. In the human being's limited freedom to organize an opposition against the authority any way he likes. But you have certain...
I don't understand you. If you want to organize an opposition in the United States, short of killing people...
Yes. Well,
as I understand
hold right there, short of killing people. Yeah. Why do you say that?
Well, because those are the rules.
This is just what I'm saying. So you have to operate within a limited scope.
The rules of democracy are that the art of persuasion has to be practiced short of assassination.
No, I understand that. But I want to be clear to you. It's also the same principle operating in socialist or communist governments.
Give me an example.
You're allowed...
Where?
Let's choose for...
Czechoslovakia.
Example,
how about Czechoslovakia?
Let's choose the People's Republic of China.
All right. What are you allowed to do?
You're allowed to organize opposition...
No, you're not.
...against...
No, you're not.
But we disagree in fact now, and that's a real contradiction.
Tell me one authority on China who says you can. Name one.
We could start with...
Start with anybody.
Pardon me?
Start with anybody.
Start with Chou En-lai.
When did he say you could organize an opposition?
I'll tell you when. When I spoke to him in the People's Republic of China, that I had about 6 hours private talk with him, And I had many hours of talk with responsible members of the Central Committee of the Chinese Communist Party. And I was very shocked because I suddenly realized, and I was sort of ashamed too, that I was brainwashed by Western thought, because what I heard, I didn't think that no matter, before I went, I would have lied to you and said, oh, you could, you have freedom of speech in China. You know, deep down, because I believe that they were moving towards...
How can you organize opposition without freedom of speech?
Let me finish. If you interrupt before I finish the idea, then we'll talk about contrary things and we won't have the contradiction that we're attempting to have anyway. I'm saying that as I sat there, this Chinese said that, you know, comrade, that all state administrations are oppressive to someone. And he started to explain in capital state that the people who own the capital, they're minority, and they oppress the majority of the people through exploitation. You know, you call rhetoric. I was listening. And he said that in national state, that sometimes a whole nation will oppress the rest of the world and with their state national administration. So there's still a minority oppressing the majority of the world's people, like the Hitler regime attempted to do, and like this regime attempted to do, to a point.
Let me finish.
I haven't gotten to the meat. I insist that I give you the antidote.
So
what I thought was so shocking was this last statement, and I'll be very brief, and I'll talk fast. I said, well, comrade, what about, you said all state administration, what about the communists, what about your progressive socialist state? Is that also oppressive? And then he said, yes. He said that while you have state administration that we expropriate from the people, because if the people in this country, if they earn $10 an hour, we only give them $8. The only difference in us and the capitalist state is that our appropriation is different. That we don't have private ownership, so we give that $2 we expropriated from the people back in the general welfare in the capitalist state, that they give it to themselves in their pocket. So therefore, the people are still not as free as we'd like for them to be. They say we work for the dissolution of the state. We work for our own disappearance. And when he said that, I said, sedition. He works for the end of the communist regime of China. And I thought that was very honest. I met so much honesty there. And I thought that was a very free statement. And that's a statement that would lead me to believe that if he's working for the dissolution of the state, that an opposition could arise to work for that withering away of territorial boundary lines. When China, as Russia has already done, strays from this philosophy, I will stray from my respect for them. The United States is, as far as the West is concerned, that there are many democratic principles that the people in China probably don't enjoy, according to what you would call democratic principles.
This is not going to go on as a monologue.
Fairness.
I'm attempting to pin down a point, and yeah. I'm losing track of it.
You think
it may be that one of the difficulties you have as chief spokesman for the Black Panther Party is your total incoherence.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, people don't understand what you're talking about. I'm a very close listener.
I think you're very limited in your definition of things. Perhaps you don't understand, but we do have an audience here, and we have an audience throughout the country.
That's right. You've had an audience for six years, and you have 2,000 members.
I think that only through empirical evidence, the observation experience, I'll let the people judge whether I'm incoherent or not.
Yeah.
Now, whether I'm incoherent or not could be tested right now. Did anyone here understand me? You're allowed to speak. Thank you. Well, sometimes I do speak in a conglomeration of gibberish. I'm not very schooled in the technique, but that you have here.
Now, listen,
I am schooled in honesty.
Why don't we not talk? about but, your limitations or my limitations.
Well, you brought them up. I was going to spare you and not tell you that sometimes you lose your shirt and your suit.
Yeah.
But you do that, and I hope that you don't do it too often. I'm glad you found it.
Let's see if we can isolate one point. It went as follows.
You're not getting frustrated,
I'll recapitulate. No.
I like talking to you.
I'm glad you do. You're manifesto. we are trying to isolate the question whether there is a right to organize opposition within China. You said, who agrees with you that there is? You said Zhou Enlai.
Mm-hmm.
You then proceeded to tell me what Zhou Enlai said to you in a way that didn't actually...
I could tell you other names, Comrade Wigwei, Comrade Tong, Comrade Lee. You wouldn't know the difference. I named a person that you probably are familiar with. They say that you're well-read and you're conscious of world events, so I only name one of the officials in China so that you could identify him. And I don't know how many officials you know, and certainly you don't know the people. I doubt if you've been to the villages, the countryside of China, or have you? I think I heard that you did go.
Are you aware of the message that
Zhou Enlai?
Yes, I have. Are you aware of the message that Zhou Enlai sent to Allende?
I saw the letter.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And you remember that he said that he does not believe that Marxism can be ushered in via parliamentary democracy. In other words, Zhou Enlai, in that particular statement, said that he does not believe in the right to organize an opposition, that it is contrary to the dialectic of Marxism.
Hold just one minute. I would like to make this clear, and for the audience and for yourself. I don't know about Zhou Enlai, but one thing that I'm not a Marxist. Not a Marxist. I think that the whole concept of what Marx tried to lay down as a scholar, a historian, a philosopher, was distorted, and people became priests of Marx and of other people. I'm not. I think that Marx was a scientist, and he tried to point out a very advanced method of analyzing phenomena that was called dialectical materialism. And you can't usher in dialectical materialism because that's the whole order and process that the universe goes through. In other words, I explained one of the principles is that contradiction is the ruling principle of the universe. It gives motion to matter, and contradiction is based upon internal strife. And that internal strife between inside of any physical thing seems to give it the ability to move and to be transformed. And societies are people, or my fellow revolutionaries, who think that you can usher in a social order through any sort of ideological proclamation, they're very wrong. The society itself strains to fight against colonialism, such as America did with England, and then after that you get a situation where workers, the unions, they struggle against the owners of the factories, and then you come up with some other sort of order, and it's much different than the formalities of the ballot. You don't know where it's really going to land until you become such a scientist, the people, to they can harness the forces that are in operation and set them in a direction that's most desirable.
Why don't we get a little bit more concrete, if you don't mind? Let's talk about the Black Panther movement. Those who want your...
I like to argue theory with you probably better than factual things.
Well, yeah, I'm a little bit more interested in factual things.
I thought you were a theoretician.
People who want your corrections on Marx can read your book.
I haven't seen any of your programs. And I'm sorry you read my book, and I'm embarrassed. I haven't ever read anything that you've done. So you probably know more about me than I know about you as a person. But I was inclined to believe
I said factual, not personal things. I don't want to talk about personal things.
I was inclined to believe that you were a thinker, somewhat of a scholar, and a theoretician. But I'm usually wrong about those things.
Well, I'm also a yachtsman, which does mean that we're here to discuss boats.
I don't know anything about the facts
of
boats.
Let's talk about that.
So I could talk to you about that, but I know something about theory.
Let's talk about your practical knowledge. Why did you feel it necessary to expel Eldridge Cleaver?
Of course, first that he left the party, and we thought that it was a good time for him to leave because in organizations, parties, and companies, you know, you get very bright, articulate people, and they have great influence upon others, and people are impressed. And I've learned not to follow my first impression as I used to when I was younger. And but when you get a person in who's articulate, bright, eloquent, and also very hurt because of the oppression that he's gone through and driven somewhat sick, too sick to be in that position, but yet with great influence, he leads the whole administration, the whole organization down the drain.
By doing what? What was it that led you down the drain?
Well, when the party started in October 1966 in Oakland, we had the occasion as a strategy to arm ourselves in a police alert patrol where we would follow the police. We were very careful to follow city ordinance about gun regulation and state law and constitutional right. And but we realized it wasn't a principle of revolution or a principle of the party that you pick up the gun now, and the gun was the only thing that defined revolution. So it was a strategy that was mistook after I went to prison with Eldridge's influence, that the gun was not only the symbol of revolution, it was a revolution. So the rhetoric then only pointed not to our programs where we attempted to organize the communities, the black community in particular, so that we could create what was destroyed through our slavery so many years ago, and that's that comprehensive collection of institutions that we call community. We wanted to establish this, and we had to treat the issues of the people we're most concerned about. Now, after I went to prison, then with his influence and much of the respect that I personally gave him, so it's my fault also, that the media, they enjoyed the big sensationalism of the gun, this, the gun, that. So in many ways that we set ourselves up for the murder that we received, and the violations we received upon our person, and the people then were afraid, no, this is not what we want, when we were not about that anyway. So these are things that we have to live with. That those are the mistakes, and one of the mistakes, and one of the contradictions we have with our organization, but you have it with any. You have to be very careful and not be too swayed by just the eloquence of a person, that he should not have ever arrived at that position, which I personally appointed him to shortly after he had gotten out of Folsom Prison. And so Eldridge Cleaver is, I accept him as mainly my responsibility, that that I contributed so much to almost the destruction of our party and so many fallen comrades who now in their grave or in prison. These are the things that I have to live with.
Now, so he, your point is that his emphasis on the need to use arms damaged the public image of the Black Panther
and the effectiveness in organizing the community, because only the people make a change that sometimes I call a revolution. That all an organization or a party can be is a vehicle or a spark to get popular support, and then the people carry out changes such as they desire. Mm-hmm. And your organization, of course, will be ineffective if your spark is in the wrong direction. If that's in left field and the wheat is in right field, then you get no place. But then you could have the spark in the same field, and the spark then will be consumed by the enthusiasm of the people, and the organization will become less important.
Now, so if Eldridge Cleaver were to return to this country and challenge your leadership, are you quite confident that you would win any test of popularity against him?
Well, many people who consider me a leader, really, I don't. We probably could argue about that, what that means. If it means what most people, especially my friends, think that it means, or I think that they entertain the meeting, I reject that. I'm not a leader. I view myself as somewhat of an organizer, as humble as I may be, that I've learned how to start to organize people so that they can protest and they can somehow get what they want. And, of course, that I only indulge with those people where I have a subjective support for them in the first place. And we deal with the objective kind of situation to see what changes can be made, what changes I see that I could support, because some that changes that I don't support. And then I wouldn't call them a revolutionary change. That's my subjective definition.
So
I'm not a leader, I'm an organizer, and that's the way I work. I'm not a speaker even. I'm terrified of cameras, radios, and large groups. I only pretend that I'm not, and that's why I'm so belligerent with you and forceful and aggressive. That's to hide my fear.
So you think that your organizing talent would result in a victory over Eldridge Cleaver, not your forensic talent or your theoretical?
Well, if Eldridge Cleaver was able to, just hypothetically, to organize the people, then that would be a statement where then history would denounce me and justify him, or else history would justify my way of doing things or my influence in the party, because really it's the party that really makes things move, that I'm influential. I have a vote, and my vote's probably worth more in influence than many other comrades, and I think that I work for that to be changed as they become more clear and gather the expertise in organizing, because that will make us all stronger. Mm-hmm. So it wouldn't be a fight. I can't, after I stretch my imagination, I can't conceive of a fight between Eldridge and myself for leadership of anything. If Eldridge, in other words, if the party, that particular group of people, they know her very well. If they said that, well, I think that Eldridge Cleaver is his rightful place, then I would bow out. Mm-hmm. It's the biggest problem. I don't think that Eldridge will come back, but hypothetically again, if he were to come back, that I think quickly the media would drop him, because we have an affectionate name for him. We call him an MF, media freak. And so the media then, they created this kind of ghost split. They listen to him, and then they give some credence to Eldridge Cleaver as a representative of a small, large party or faction. But we can't, the people in all of the cities in the country can't ever find any small cult, party, or anything. He has other imps who will, as soon as a news reporter comes and puts the camera up, he starts talking, and then what's created is what I call a media organization. It's a little different than a paper organization, but we're in a push-button world now. Mm-hmm. So, right.
Yeah, well, now, given your organizing talent and your superior theoretical position, why is it that you don't
flatter
have
me saying that?
I'm accepting your definition of yourself.
I like to think of myself as somewhat an organizer with some expertise, but I'm not very good, really. If I were good, then America would be changed tomorrow or yesterday. But we're still struggling on precinct levels, making many turns and many maneuvers.
I know that you're struggling, but what I'm anxious to know.
But I couldn't be that good then, because.
No, not necessarily. After all.
I'm saying on objective evidence that not too many of the changes that I desire have been made as rapidly as I desired, but everything's in a constant state of transformation. America's certainly changed, that the blacks' our status in the country is different than it was. In 1619, that I would have to acknowledge that. I would have to acknowledge contributors to the people struggles such as Martin Luther King. I would have to acknowledge John Brown. Denmark Vesey, Nat the Prophet Turner, that I would have to acknowledge people who have contributed to the change in America.
Well, who said you shouldn't? I don't know what you're up to right now.
No, I'm only up to this.
I'm not saying...
I'm only up to this. I'm saying that we all play a part and attempting to change things so that we will not have the physical clash that causes inevitably death of men. And myself, that I reject violence, that I would like to see a world where there's no need for it, and it no longer will have to exist. Because I think that the death of any man diminishes all of us because we're involved with humanity. Mm-hmm. Now, I say that while doing this, the reason that we are so bullheaded and so many armies clash in the night is because we don't have the concept of, as Nietzsche says, that other shore. You know, I love the great despisers for their my great adorers, arrows longing for other shore. And I would like to admit to you that I don't have the answer to even start to resolve the contradiction of this country so that we can have that new order. But I do have a desire, a desperate desire, to reach the other shore. And I think that each day, each minute, that whether we know it or not, that we're slowly, in the world generally, we're slowly arriving at some other level, some other relationship between people. And I just work for the hopeful goal that this new level of relationship between men will be as desirable as possible between all of us, whether you define yourself philosophically as a conservative, as a progressive, as a reactionary, or a revolutionist. But I think all of these labels, that they really clutter our conversation, and it makes it possible for me to speak all this gibberish you're talking about. But it's frustrating, huh?
Mr. Right. Sinkin from Trinity College.
Yes, well, I've enjoyed the exploration of Mr. Newton's views.
You know, I always accuse myself of really speaking in a conglomeration of gibberish, and he's made me very insecure. Do you think that maybe I hit on something of importance to you?
I felt what you said was quite clear in the concepts you were exploring.
Well, it seems that Mr. Buckley is the only dunce around here so far.
I'm a little more interested in getting even more practical than either of you reached, and down to present social policies in the cities, in the inner cities, the continuing and ever-recurring crisis in the inner city of large numbers of people seemingly trapped in an endless cycle of poverty, and whether either of you can suggest and agree upon, which I think would be remarkable, a social policy for the inner city which would lead to the reduction of tensions, the new levels of communication. And
I have some ideas.
You go right ahead.
Well, first, I would like to make this very clear so that Mr. Buckley and myself won't go on another tangent. That I saw it crystal clear on how that we could start to reduce the kind of conflicts that we have in this country. I saw an example of it in China. Now, this is not China. It's a whole other culture. Their history is different, so therefore their transformation will be different. Things will take a different shape. But what I saw was this. There, when I went there, that I was very unenlightened. I thought that I knew something about China, but I thought that, like it's said so often, that China will be a homogeneous kind of racial, ethnic territory. But then I found out that 50% of the Chinese territory is occupied by 54% of people who are national minorities, they call them, with 10, and they call it top 10, and statistically in the large ethnic minorities. And I thought, and they speak a different language. They look much different. They eat a different food, and but yet no conflict. And I observed one thing, that each region, like we call cities, like we call now, we say community control, each region is absolutely controlled by those ethnic minority people, but yet they're still Chinese. Now, say that if another ethnic person are living, say, in the Wigwe territory. Say if a Hun is living, if I say that correctly, as a majority group there in China, then ask, well, what happens? How is he treated? Can he hold office in your city or your regional administration? And say yes if he's voted in, but we feel that the people there have a right, they know more about the culture and their needs and how to implement the institutions.
Would
that
include the Tibetans?
Pardon me?
Would that include the Tibetans?
Yes.
Well, hold now.
There was a big conflict for so long.
Yeah. They call it genocide.
Well, all right then. And of course, that if you talk about genocide, that if the Chinese have done wrong, they're in the barrel with the rest of us, with England as well as America, and their genocide against blacks, with the whole,
what do you call the cultural revolution?
The whole Western world,
what do you call the cultural
revolution?
Crucified
over 50 million blacks alone that America took part in. So you could call it genocide. You know, when we put titles on things, you know, I even go, ah. And so I'm not even talking about whether I agree with the way they handle this particular ethnic minority. If I start to do this, I would get into, I'm saying that I disagree with them. I say they do administer their region at this point. How they were treated some time past, we would have to argue just factual information on it. I'm not willing to do that. I'm talking about a general condition in China. So ethnic minorities, I observe, they control their whole thing, and they have a right to have a representative on the Chinese Communist Party. They have the seat waiting. Just they choose who will go. And at the same time, they have their principle, you cannot in China, and he talks about organizing opposition, you cannot, and it's true, in China you cannot vote to organize an opposition to reinstate private ownership. No more than you can here organize an opposition to take away private ownership in this country. So it's what do you choose? Well, I happen to choose the way they go about it, all right?
Thank you, so, Mr. Sinkin, for eliciting a lucid reply to the problems of the inner city. Mrs. Holland.
Did I get too theoretical again?
Oh, no, Mr. Sinkin will explain it to us later. He understands everything.
Well, before this, I would say this inner cities or the cities of this country could be organized like that.
And community control.
Community control. But at the same time, it's not like a black control and no white could come in or no Chinese could come in. I say you have democracy in the inner city, but it should, the administration should reflect the population of the people there.
And
it will if it's
no
if
capitalist
it's
like Lin Piao. Mrs. Holland.
In reading through Mr.
You say Lin Piao is a capitalist?
No, I was teasing you.
I thought that maybe we could discuss that in private, that I would say it in public. I have my criticism of Lin Piao.
All right, but let's hear from Mrs. Holland first, shall we?
Okay.
Mrs. Holland.
Mr. Newton. In reading through most of the earlier Panther material, religion was either not emphasized or de-emphasized.
Yes.
Have you and the members of your party rethought about the relevance of religion in the culture of black people in America?
I think with any people, religion is almost a necessary thing that we would engage in. Myself, I'm a very religious person. I have my definitions what religion is about and what I think when you speak of religion, you talk about God and so forth. As I analyze religions, I find that we always talk about the same God, and that is always the person or the thing in nature that we do not know, that we do not understand, that we do not control, but yet somehow it affects us. So then in the Webster Dictionary, they say that this also could be defined as ignorance, you see? You don't know God, but there's something out there. You didn't create yourself. You must be created. I find that to tell a person, don't believe in God, don't believe, is to also tell him that pretend that you know everything, all of the answers. So no matter what religion, whether it's Judaism, Christianity, Islam, God is always that thing, the unknown, they say the unknowable, and I say that it's a thing that's ignorance. It's ignorance when you don't know it, and it's wisdom when you do. And so the scriptures, you know, my father has been a minister ever since I can remember, that he used to always tell me, you know, that the church is in the heart of men, and God grows within. So as we eliminate our ignorance and our God stops being ignorance but becomes wisdom, then he grows within, and then we'll really know who God is. We'll see that we walk with him, that we talk with him. We'll find ourselves, and we'll know that our pipe has been in our mouth all the time. We'll know really who we are, and we'll know who God is. We'll find that he's the all, really, which is a nonsense term now. Man only knows events in between the beginning and the end. Both of those are words that maybe Mr. Buckley can define, but I can't. But we know there's something outside of events that we don't understand. We're a very motley crew, really, at this time in our evolution.
Mr. Mounds?
Yes. I have a question for you, Mr. Buckley. Much of the emphasis, my research, perhaps the concerns of students here today, has been on looking at the Panthers in the past 2 or 3 years and seeing a great deal of metamorphosis that has taken place. And probably we still have many more questions for Mr. Newton about where the Panthers stand now compared with the past. But I would like to ask you if you have undergone a metamorphosis in your own appraisal. Some of your earlier statements about the Panthers were rather strong.
Places.
And I was curious about your present appraisal.
Well, my judgment, as publicly made of the Panther movement, was based on an examination of its own literature. I read the Panther paper and described its contents and its publications. I think it's probably true that whoever edited it was rather hyper-virulent, and that it's probably true that a lot of people who were in the party themselves a little bit taken aback by it. And the saner element appears to have prevailed. But I don't think it's a historical exaggeration to say that the Black Panther Party, to the extent that one could infer its thoughts from its declarations, was based on the need to despise the white race.
Well, could I suggest an example?
Sure.
In one, I believe it was Looker, it could have been National Review article, you disagreed very strongly with Dick Gregory, who had indicated that the militant stance and symbolism and rhetoric functionally could actually displace violence, if you see what I mean. Could you accept that as a phenomena of a positive good that the Panthers have contributed?
Yes, I could. Unfortunately, as much could be said of the Ku Klux Klan, but it is true. Dick Gregory gave a concrete example, you may not remember, about a black woman who felt intimidated. This was about 2 or 3 years ago, and she called the Black Panther headquarters there, and they sent someone to look out for her, and he was armed. On the basis of the assurance that she got from his presence, she did calm down and recovered her stability. And there's no question that people can perform that kind of a function armed in that kind of a way, and I have no doubt that here and there the Black Panthers did.
Well, I would like to say this, and I'm sorry if I interrupt, when people
sure.
equate the Black Panther Party with such people as the Ku Klux Klan and White Citizen Council, I get sort of upset. I agree that I would like to see a world, and we agree on more points than we probably have time to realize now, but the point that dialogue, just the energy, dialectical struggle, or struggle just through the word. I would hope that will probably be the next advance that man will come through and put the club down. But I think that there's certain objective kind of difficulties of reaching that point immediately. I think that things just don't happen. You start, but as long as there's a especially a special economic interest that one has to support, an authority that he has to support, then he creates a rhetoric in order to sell that to a group, to an army, to henchmen, then I think that this kind of dialogue will be inflammatory and cause much violence and so forth. And I will even point out the history of the Black Panther Party. I think the rhetoric ran amok with the leadership, the influence of Eldridge Cleaver, and it caused many murders, that it laid the foundation so that even the black community could say that, oh, those bad guys out there, you see, they only want violence and robbers and so forth. This kind of rhetoric, I think, can promote physical conflict that dialogue itself carries no sort of virtue unless it's pointed into a direction in order to resolve a problem, you see?
What about the role today of the Panthers? You indicate, for example, in your To Die for the People, that one of the first priorities is education, but you don't actually define that. Do you mean political education, use of the media, or do you mean formal education? For example, would you have advice for the black students here today?
Most of us think we've been programmed by our schools and our universities to think in categories. And that's very much different than thinking dialectically, where many, many things are in play at the same time, and that we think that education means formal education, perhaps, or maybe it means political education, or define what do you mean. When I say education, I mean a lifting of the consciousness of the people, and where external stimuli will bombard the human organism, and then from that process you begin to have some sort of awareness of what's going on, because I agree with Sigmund Freud, that's the first step then in controlling what's wrong with you or the social forces. You have to know what you're dealing with to start. So when I say education, I mean it in the broadest sense of the word, that technical education. We're living in a very technical world now, thanks to the West. If you want to say thank you, I think that it is a contribution to humanity. I don't like how they arrived at it. I accuse them of trespass, tibonus aspertatus, that they took away other people's goods, and they dominated them as their very own, and that wealth snowballed, and certain people were able to inherit without even working at all, such as my friend here, and then protect that interest of the right of inheritance, you see? And so I say education, be conscious and know as much as you possibly can so that we can start dealing with this garbage pile we call society.
For the record, while you were relaxing in jail, I was working.
Maybe you call working right in your mouth. I don't, on these TV programs.
I don't see the calluses
on your head. What?
I was writing all those books you didn't read.
I'd like to go back to your...
What I understand about the books, it didn't take too much time to do that. They're very much like your conversation here. And I'm only joking with you because I really enjoy the conversation. No, truly. I find you very entertaining, and I like the hot kind of... debate where we have to struggle to get the seed, you know. So I'm sorry if I was hard to take, but you've proven yourself to be that gentleman that everyone says that you are, in spite of all the other criticisms. I probably
Mr. Sinkin, I think we had just as we've got a second.
Going back to your idea of community control, recognizing that we haven't succeeded to date in the ideal of integration in our community, and that community control would be one way of almost recognizing reality. What happens to the fact that community control means that people in the inner city, for example, control a decaying, dying city?
But see, that troubles me. You're still thinking, and it makes me so mad because you're still thinking.
I'm afraid you're going to have to answer this after the program is over. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Bring that up again.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
We're taught to think in the wrong way. When I say community control, from your standpoint,